It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the program in our basket of quick conversations to end the news week, we'll talk with IPR Sarah Bowden about Planned Parenthood's moves to try to stop these new Iowa abortion restrictions. Dean Borg will be along introducing us to the new president of the Iowa Board of Regents. Also, Erin Jordan of the Gazette. She's been covering that high-profile employment discrimination case. A decision on that came down yesterday. But first of all, yesterday, House Republicans all over the news finally did it with the help of all three of Iowa's GOP House members, Congressman Blum, Young and King. After 7 years of repeal and replace rhetoric against the Affordable Care Act and that recent high-profile failure just a few weeks ago, House Republicans passed their bill. Joining us now to tell us what that might mean for Iowans, Pete Damiano, director of the Public Policy Center and the Health Policy Research Program at the University of Iowa. Welcome back, Pete.
Thank you, Ben.
You knew you'd be getting the call from us when we saw these things happening in Congress. And now, of course, political analysts, we're not looking at it really politically here, say the version of this bill is unlikely to become law. But let's see what three-quarters of Iowa's House congressional delegation voted for here. How does it stack up next to the ACA?
Well, it obviously depends on your perspective. The big changes, and a lot of those are similar to what we had talked about the last time, that you're going to have a change in the individual insurance market, which has been, you know, pretty huge, and the questions about going on with the stability of the market and all those kinds of things in terms of the types of subsidies for people who get insurance through the health insurance exchanges. Mm-hmm. So these are those individuals that don't get insurance through their workplace, go to the healthcare.gov site, be able to purchase insurance. The way that subsidy is going to change from an income-based subsidy, which it is now, to an age-based subsidy, and then it's going to be a flat amount that you're going to get. It's not going to be a sliding scale based on income, which right now between 100% and 400% of poverty, the amount of your subsidy to buy an individual private insurance plan was scaled, you know, more if you're lower income, less as you were getting closer to that 400%. Now it's going to be these categories based on age.
Mm-hmm. And it's going to be that disadvantages who compared to what we have?
In general, the changes from the ACA to the AHCA, it's going to benefit from a premium perspective, specifically younger, healthier people, and it's going to disadvantage people who are older and people with pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm. We don't have any Congressional Budget Office numbers here. This
right.
was voted on in less than 24 hours through the House. No calculation. I don't know if you can say anything to that. Of course, the big number that stuck out at the last version back in March was 24 million losing their health insurance.
Right. From my perspective and what I've been reading, even though we don't have the CBO numbers and we don't know for sure, there's not a lot in this that's going to change that number of people who are uninsured significantly. In the negotiation that's happened since that time, they first basically reached out to conservatives in the Freedom Caucus and gave them a bone, if you will, which was that there's going to be more state flexibility in terms of what the states could do with the required benefit package, which is required under the ACA. And there's been concern, well, why do I have to pay for pregnancy care if I'm a young male and mm-hmm. some of those kinds of things, or mental health coverage because I don't use mental health services, things like that. Mm-hmm. So they put that in to get the conservative vote, which is, it may not lose numbers of people, but it will make the policies for many people less, I mean, depending on what the state is and what they decided to and how they want to do it. Then they reached out to try to counter that a little bit to the more moderates to get them in by throwing $8 billion in over 5 years to create high-risk pools or the potential that states could request money to subsidize the higher-income people. And as we've talked about before, prior to the ACA and the individual insurance market, those people are going out and buying it themselves, it was really broken from the consumer perspective, that if you had a pre-existing condition or you got sick while you were covered, you could either – they wouldn't sell it to you or the price would be so high you couldn't afford it or they'd drop you. With the ACA, they could no longer do that. Instead, they said to the insurance companies, hey, we're going to do this individual mandate, which is the part everybody hates, but everybody's got to buy insurance, so we get this good risk pool. We gained a bunch of people, put more people into Medicaid who tended to be sicker, but it still wasn't good enough. And so now some of these changes are trying to go back toward the insurance companies, if you will. So like with the high-risk pools, well, we're going to pull those people out. So the really sick people, we will subsidize them in a different way.
Mm, okay. So what about Medicaid, which was expanded under the Affordable Care Act?
Right. So Medicaid originally was expanded, and the federal government paid 100% of the cost of all of the new members for the first 3 years and then 90% since then. The changes that are going to be made and will be implemented over the next few years is that they're going to change that, and instead of an entitlement program where the states get whatever it takes to basically pay for this, they're going to cap it, and they're either going to cap it on a per-member cost basis or they're going to block grant and the state get X amount of money based on 2016 numbers, that's what they will then get. It's going to push more of the costs onto the state because in doing this, the reason they're doing this is to try to cut costs. Well, the state's costs are either going to have to be borne somewhere else or they're going to have to drop people from the program. In addition, the match and the cost adjustment for the expansion population, which, as you know, not all states did, but Iowa did, will get cut back. So it'll no longer be anything close to that 90%, and that as they're estimating what it will be in that cap per capita basis or the block grant approach.
Let's talk a little bit before we say goodbye about the instability we've seen across the country, also here in Iowa. We've had insurers leaving the Iowa market. I guess we have Minnesota-based Medica, the sole insurer for how many Iowans?
There are about 14,000 Iowans, but the most important aspect of their talk of leaving, they haven't said they're leaving yet. It was a little bit of a guarded threat, if you will, but I think they're saying, look, if this doesn't change, you know, we're not going to be able to stay. And because with Wellmark pulling out and with Coventry pulling out, they're left with basically all of the potential bad risk. And they're saying, hey, unless you do the high-risk pools or some other way of subsidizing, keep the cost subsidies for the people who are buying the private insurance where they are and do a few other things in terms of getting into the market and out, we can't do this alone.
And what about the political situation? How does that affect insurers? It must be as if they have sand shifting beneath their feet.
Well, that's part of the problem. Then insurance companies do not like uncertainty, right? I mean, the whole thing about actuarial calculations is all based on odds. And when you've got this very fluid sand on your feet political situation and not knowing, and they have to make a decision in 6 weeks in terms of whether they're going to be in the market for 2018, you know, that doesn't work real well. And so I would be very surprised if this goes through the House, through the Senate, gets signed during that time period so that there's going to be enough stability to know. And I mean, whether Medica will do anything or some other company would come into Iowa, but it basically would leave Iowa without the ability, other than five counties where Gunderson is in northeast Iowa. If you don't get health insurance through your employer, you're not going to be able to buy a policy in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, as we wrap up here in a few seconds, I wanted to read you from the Washington Post this morning to see if from your public policy perspective you agree. They're saying, well, remember when Republicans were going to repeal Obamacare? This doesn't do that. It says it basically just tinkers with reforming Obamacare. Is that a way to look at this, that it's not a repeal of Obamacare? It takes a lot of things over, or is it too early to say?
I think it's too early to say. This is, you know, throwing the gauntlet down and a starting point. The way it's been described is many House members voted for this with the hope and intention that the Senate will fix a number of the things in there. Whether they can fix enough so that, you know, the promises that the president made while campaigning and other things, that nobody's going to lose coverage, that there's no problem with people with pre-existing conditions, all those things get fixed by the time it gets to the Senate, back to the House, and then back to the president. I mean, that'll be the sort of the wait and see.
Okay. Pete Damiano, to be continued, director of the Public Policy Center and the Health Policy Research Program at the University of Iowa, talking about the latest developments with the repeal and replace bill passing the House yesterday. Thanks, Pete.
Yep. Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Other news this week, in fact, developing news on this front, planned this morning, Planned Parenthood of the Heartland is appealing to the Iowa Supreme Court to stop new abortion restrictions that I think went into effect today. It's a new law mandating a 72-hour waiting period between two appointments before a woman receives an abortion. And joining me now, Sarah Bowden, Iowa Public Radio reporter in our Ames studio. Hi, Sarah. You've been following this morning, and And what are the latest developments?
Yeah, so Ben, this is a rapidly developing story. Governor Terry Branstad at about 8:30 this morning signed a bill that, among other things, instates a 72-hour waiting period for a woman between two appointments before she receives an abortion. A couple hours later, so this provision was only in effect for roughly 2 hours. So a couple hours later, the Iowa Supreme Court issued a temporary injunction that suspends this provision until at least Monday at noon, when the state can respond to an appeal from Planned Parenthood of the Heartland that says that this provision creates an undue burden to women seeking abortion. So this is very fast moving.
Go into the reasoning there, the undue burden. How so, an undue burden?
Yeah, so Planned Parenthood says that this creates a burden for all women, but especially poor women, rural women, women who may be at risk of domestic violence. And that's because not only do women have to wait 72 hours between for their abortion, but there's this sort of two appointment requirement. So a woman goes to her doctor, she gets an ultrasound, a piece of paper signed, and then 3 days later she comes back for the procedure. And Planned Parenthood says that for women who have to travel to a clinic for an abortion, or women who are poor and therefore have to arrange childcare, time off work, which means loss of wages, that's unfair to them. And also women who might be victims of domestic violence, and so therefore they might want to conceal their pregnancy from their partner, because a lot of times pregnancy and forcing a partner to be pregnant is a form of abuse. Planned Parenthood says that this new provision puts all those women at risk.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, this waiting period, 72-hour waiting period, now there's an injunction on that. Is that the only portion of the law that is being contested?
That and the two, it's kind of intertwined with the two visit requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So listeners probably know this bill that was just signed into law as the 20-week ban.
Mm-hmm.
That ban is still in place. So now women in Iowa, as of about 8:30 this morning, can't have an abortion after 20 weeks, with some very few exceptions, like I believe health of the mother is at risk. Don't quote me on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so equal protection rights fits into the reasoning here as well. Explain that.
Yeah, so like the U.S. Constitution, Iowa's Constitution has an equal protection clause, and that basically means that everyone needs to be treated equally. And because only people with uteruses have pregnancies, it's unfair to people, women, or people who have female sex reproductive organs.
Mm-hmm.
This law only affects them in an unfair way.
Mm-hmm. As you watch this, we'll look forward to your coverage of it. And any guesses as how this will come out as we move forward?
Right. So at noon on Monday, that's the deadline for the state to file a response to this very temporary injunction. And then the court will decide if the injunction will go forward. And then there will be more litigation. So there's going to be a trial that will, I'm almost certain, going to end up at the state Supreme Court. So we're really just getting started.
Okay, Sarah Bowden in our Ames studio, Iowa Public Radio reporter, following the Planned Parenthood of the Heartland's moves to stop new abortion restrictions that went into effect, enacted by our legislature, going into effect today, a temporary injunction on those. Sarah Bowden, thanks for the latest on that.
Thanks, Ben.
It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to get to in this half hour, this long trial. You've heard it in the news. A Polk County jury yesterday awarded a former University of Iowa athletics administrator, Jane Meyer, over $1.4 million. The jury finding that the University of Iowa discriminated against her based on gender and sexual orientation. Joining me now, Aaron Jordan, Cedar Rapids Gazette reporter. Welcome to our studio. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you, Ben.
For coming in. Tell us the story behind this case. Jane Meyer worked for the UI beginning in 2001 up to 2016.
Yeah, that's right. She was an associate athletics director for about 13 years until 2014. And her partner, Tracy Grisbaum, had been a very successful field hockey coach at the University of Iowa. In August of 2014, the athletics director, Gary Barda, fired Coach Grisbaum because of some allegations from student athletes about some verbal abuse. And, you know, it sounds like that second half of 2014 is what a lot of this trial was based on. You know, Jane Meyer, you know, raised sometimes in a strong voice a lot of the issues she saw about her partner's firing, and then also about some other gender equity issues in the department. And then she was transferred out of athletics at the end of 2014.
Mm-hmm. It's important. Tracy can be a man or a woman's name. This Tracy, her partner, is a woman.
That's right.
And did that play a part in the argumentation here, the case?
Yeah, you know, this trial was, there was a lot of testimony, a lot of high-profile witnesses, football coach Kirk Ferentz, Gary Barda was on the stand himself for parts of 4 days. So, you know, the question of whether Jane Meyer should have told Gary Barda that she was in a relationship with Tracy Grisbaum came up. It was determined by the university that that did not fall under the university's conflict of interest policy, but Barda testified he felt like he should have been told. So that came out a little bit, but it wasn't certain what role that played in the verdict.
Over $1.4 million awarded to Jane Meyer by the jury. How did we arrive at that number? How did they arrive at that number?
Sure. Well, $374,000 of it are her back wages since when she was terminated last fall. And then roughly $440,000 of it are related to past emotional stress, and then about $600,000 are for future emotional distress.
Mm-hmm. The University of Iowa's reaction?
Very limited so far. You know, they've said they're disappointed by the verdict. I just heard back from them before I came into the studio here. They say they're going to wait on a decision to appeal until the post-trial motions are concluded.
Mm-hmm. So they could appeal. That there could be another step to this. Is perhaps not the final word on this
case.
Yeah,
that's right.
Mm-hmm. Now, to Tracy Grisbaum, she sued the University of Iowa. That's coming up?
Yeah.
That trial?
Tracy Grisbaum's case is scheduled to go to trial June 5th, so, you know, a month from today. And it will be interesting to see whether the outcome of the Meyer case has any impact on the Grisbaum case.
And Grisbaum's case is about?
It's very similar. I think it has to do with gender and sexual orientation discrimination based on the fact that they fired her when she would say that some of her behaviors were exhibited by other male coaches in the athletic department.
Mm-hmm. You spoke with Jane Meyer, I believe, as part of your reporting. What does she see as the significance of this decision?
Yeah, I talked with her yesterday evening. She was clear to say it's about more than just her. She feels like she hopes this verdict gives women who are similarly situated in other athletics departments the ability to speak out. You know, I have to say, you know, she seemed a lot more lighthearted in that conversation than she did at trial. She was very serious the whole time. At least that was her outward demeanor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's look at some other things that you're reporting on. One other thing in particular, an investigation. You're looking, last spring, federal investigators conducted a probe in response to a probe last spring. Let's tie this up first here. University of Iowa Athletic Department, that it does not provide equal opportunities for female athletics. Where does that investigation stand?
Yeah, the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights is still investigating this gender equity question that was raised by some former field hockey players. So that's still out there.
Mm-hmm. So what would be a case made for unequal opportunities? Is it back to the male coaches treat their male students differently than female coaches are allowed to?
You know, that could be part of it. The university had to submit documentation to the OCR about everything like size of locker rooms, distance traveled, number of uniforms different teams have, men's and women's teams. So it really gets down to a very detailed analysis.
Mm-hmm. Is there a timeline that you're looking at?
You know, the OCR doesn't tell you when they're going to decide or when they're going to, you know, come down with anything, if they will.
Mm-hmm. You've also, Aaron Jordan, been investigating the revenue and spending of the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation. Tell us a little bit about what prompted you to look into this.
You know, during the legislative session, there was a lot of worries and rumors going around that the Farm Bureau had been behind different pieces of legislation, including the bill that would have kind of disbanded the Des Moines Waterworks, who, if you remember, they had sued some northern Iowa drainage districts about nitrates in the water. And, you know, I just figured there's a lot of urbanites that don't know about the Farm Bureau, and I needed to learn more, too. So I dug into their financial records and, you know, a lot of documents I found online. Their president was willing to give me an extensive interview. So I learned quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the, I mean, you, in your reporting, a little bit of the history of the Farm Bureau. I believe you completely. People know that this is one of the terms people know, especially living in Iowa. But ask them what they do, and most people would draw a blank, wouldn't they?
Right. Yeah, they've been around for almost 100 years. They support the interests of farmers, support farm families, I think, is part of their motto. You know, there's a lot of legislation that they're involved in lobbying, although their tax forms don't say to how much they spend on that. They advocate for farmers in a variety of ways. And, you know, one thing I thought was interesting in my reporting was how rich the organization is. You know, they brought in $88 million in revenue in 2015, and they spent only $30 million. So they've banked over the last several years quite a bit of money. I think they're trying, and their president, Craig Hill, said they're trying to build an endowment. But, you know, what some farmers feel like is that, you know, it's interesting that they're making so much money when a lot of farmers are challenged because of low commodity prices.
It's called the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation. So there are farmers who are more pro-federation than others. How would those sort out?
Yeah, I mean, I think most farmers in general believe that the Farm Bureau is working for them, a lot of farmers. But, you know, a good chunk of Farm Bureau's members are not actually farmers. They become members in order to purchase Farm Bureau insurance. You know, if they find a good price through that, that kind of involves them becoming a member. So, you know, there's kind of differences within that big pool of farmers across the state.
Mm-hmm. What else can we expect from your investigation here in the future? Is this the end of it, or are you continuing?
You know, I think that, you know, I think the Farm Bureau is going to continue to be very involved in the shaping of water quality legislation and whether they support water quality legislation. There's a move by some GOP lawmakers this year to add a sales tax that would have supported water quality measures. The Farm Bureau did not take a stand on that. It'll be interesting to see whether that comes up again and whether they support it.
Okay, Erin Jordan, thanks for giving us an overview of some important reporting that you're doing for the Gazette. Erin Jordan of the Gazette, thanks for coming into our studio, Erin.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, we continue with this News Buzz edition of River to River. I'll talk with Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg. He'll introduce us to Mike Richards, the new president of the Iowa Board of Regents. Also, what a new county map of the state says about partisan changes in Iowa, and a look into May's Iowa Arts Showcase. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week of news. The board that oversees Iowa's three public universities has elected a new president. It was on Monday. The Iowa Board of Regents agreed to make Mike Richards its 22nd president. His one-year term as head of the nine-member board begins immediately. Governor Terry Branstad appointed Richards to the board. That was last year. He takes over for Bruce Rastetter, who had 1 year left as president. Rastetter's term on the board ended in April. Joining me now to tell us what this changing of the guard might mean, Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Hi, Dean.
Hello, Ben.
Before we talk about the new president, what about Bruce Rastetter? Why didn't he seek a second term?
Well, you said 1 year left as president of the Regents. Yes, that's an internal election, but his term ran out as an appointed regent, and so he had to have been reappointed by the governor, which probably would have happened had he sought that reappointment, but he had to be reconfirmed then by the Iowa Senate, and that was problematical. And Bruce Rastetter then I had talked with him in the months leading up when he was making decision, and he said, you know, I think I've had enough.
Mm-hmm.
problematical in the Senate. Why?
Well, his predecessor, Craig Lang, as president of the Iowa Board of Regents, with Bruce Rastetter, then president pro tem, he was appointed by the governor but didn't win confirmation in the Senate, and so he had to go off the board. Rastetter then took over. Rastetter could have been looking ahead and seeing the same thing, and it hadn't been, you know, that's a very high-profile position as president of the Board of Regents, and he had had a difficult time. And I think I would say, Ben, that the Board of Regents outside of the Iowa legislature is the most political body in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the new president, Mike Richards. What can you tell us about him? Introduce us to him.
Well, Mike Richards is a graduate of the University of Iowa with a medical doctor degree, practiced as a medical doctor, then was with the Iowa Methodist Hospital in Des Moines, which is now Unity Point, and he also had an interest in the entertainment industry, the gambling casino Wild Rose Industries, which has casinos in Emmitsburg, I believe Clinton, and I know Carroll, Iowa.
Mm-hmm. You just said that the Regents Board is the most politically appointed board. Politically charged, okay.
But Ben,
has it always been that way?
It doesn't show it in the meetings. Let me say that.
Okay.
It's off radar, out of the meetings. But has it always been that way? No, I wouldn't say so, but in recent years, it certainly has been. In fact, under Governor Vilsack, it was so politically charged, and some of the decisions there, particularly as it related to the University of Iowa, got the Vilsack administration into deep political trouble, and some regents, I think three, resigned en masse during that Vilsack administration. So there's always been, in recent years, very politically charged issues there.
I'm seeing a note here in, a Des Moines Register article that Richards donated thousands of dollars to both Branstad and Lieutenant Governor Reynolds, some $30,000 since 2013. Does that raise any eyebrows, or is that par for the course in this realm?
A short answer, par for the course.
Okay.
Par for the course.
Let's talk a little bit about the goals, what the Board of Regents has major challenges has ahead of it.
As I talked with Mike Richards, I said, what's the big thing coming up for you? Right off the bat said, finding a new president for Iowa State University. As you know, the current president, Stephen Leith, has resigned. He's going to Auburn University. There's an interim there, Ben Allen, who was the former provost at Iowa State and then president of UNI. I think the Regents are very comfortable with keeping Ben Allen on as interim and taking their time in getting a new president to replace Stephen Leith over at Iowa State. But he also said tuition, you know, that there is a deadline on that. The Iowa legislature didn't appropriate as much money as Regents had hoped. They have to make up that difference, and they probably will be raising tuition for the fall semester. So there's an immediate decision there. And then he told me he wants more openness in the Regents meeting.
I think one thing that we will want to institute is a pilot program this year, which would allow the public and all members to address the Regents in an open forum. That's one step. We're going to try it. It's never been done in the history of the Regents, and we're going to give it a shot.
Okay, the new president of the Iowa Board of Regents, Mike Richards. What prompted an open forum?
Well, people have complained that activist groups, for the most part, have complained that they can't get access to the Regents. And the Regents have not had in their meetings a mechanism for taking public comment. Mm-hmm. You just heard Mike Richards say that. They have had a list. What they've done to offset that is to set up public forums by recording, where people who wanted to comment to the Regents could go in, have their voices recorded, and then the Regents promised they would listen to those. And those were set up around the state at various locations. People complain, well, you know, I don't even know if my voice was listened to. The Regents assured them, yes, we did hear you. But you never heard any response from the Regents.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Dean, before we say goodbye, you've covered the Regents for I don't know how many years, but you certainly qualify as having a long view of it. Can you give us this step in a long view, the arc of where Iowa's public universities are heading?
Well, they have for a long time been wanting to have better understanding in the Iowa legislature of the problems that they have governing the state universities. And that's particularly true since the year, I'd say, 2000, when things in Iowa began decreasing as far as state support of the public universities, and more of that cost of running the state universities was offloaded into tuition. They want a better relationship and better communicate with the legislators, just to show legislators the tough time that they're having maintaining quality at the three state universities, keeping tuition reasonable as a public institution or public institutions at UNI, Iowa State, and the University of Iowa, and keeping academic standards very high. They want a better dialogue with the Iowa legislature. That was a goal under Bruce Rastetter. I think some of that was achieved. I think Mike Richards wants to go even further.
Okay, keeping his eye on the Board of Regents for us, Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Thanks, Dean.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa has long been referred to as a purple or swing state in terms of our politics, electing both Democrats and Republicans to Congress, and also with that mixed record for voting for presidential candidates. Barack Obama handily won Iowa both in 2008 and 2012. Donald Trump won here easily over Hillary Clinton last fall in 2016. Currently, 5 of 6 members of Congress from Iowa are Republicans, and it makes some wonder, speculate, is Iowa becoming a red state, or has it become a red state? My next guests have created a map to show changes in partisanship over the last 5 presidential elections for all counties in Iowa. Chris Larimer, our regular political analyst, is with us in Cedar Falls, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ben.
You have with you a student, Sarah Hoffmeyer, a student. Sarah, you are majoring in political science as well as public administration. Welcome to you.
Thanks.
Chris, describe what you did here with some data that you got from the Secretary of State's office, I believe.
Yeah, we did. And this is actually Sarah's project. We were looking at trying to understand how partisanship in all of Iowa's 99 counties has changed over time. And so we wanted to get a sense of the degree to which that change has taken place. And so what Sarah and I worked on is compiling data from 2000 to 2016 for each county, the proportion within each county that is registered Democrat. And we were just looking at active registered voters. And then what Sarah was able to do was apply a color gradient over all 99 counties that shows the extent to which it goes from a very light blue to a very dark blue over time, so we can see how Democratic each of these 99 counties are over a 16-year period.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah, when you put in all this data and you saw the counties changing, some changing more than others as we went through these 5 presidential elections, what jumped out at you?
Yeah, so there are some areas specifically in Iowa that don't seem to change much at all in terms of getting dark blue versus light blue. The 4 counties in northwestern Iowa, Lyon, Osceola, Sioux, and O'Brien, all stayed a light blue throughout basically the 16-year period. Others we saw change maybe a little bit darker blue or a larger change, but these stayed a light blue throughout 16 years.
Mm-hmm. And counties that we saw a lot of change in?
Yeah, so we saw a lot of change in Benton and Lynn.
Hmm. Chris, how do you explain the counties with a lot of change?
Well, I think in the case of Lynn County, what we've seen is that it's become more Democratic since 2000. But if you go back to 2000, it was a very balanced county in terms of Republicans, Democrats, and no party. But this is a county in particular that has become more Democratic over this time period. And Sarah's right. You know, Northwest Iowa is the conservative stronghold in the state. In the same way with Southwest Iowa. And you think about where Senator Joni Ernst is from down in Montgomery County. That's another county that stays a very, very light shade of blue, in this case, very conservative throughout the entire time period.
Mm-hmm. We have just over a minute left. I wonder, what do you see, Chris, as and Sarah, if you like, what's the implications going forward? Our next election is in 2018. If you were a political analyst working for a campaign, Would this be of interest, and how would you interpret it?
Well, I think it's definitely of interest, and I think what you see are the counties that are strong Democratic counties in Johnson County, in Lee County, Des Moines County, Jackson, Dubuque County. But what you also see are a lot of counties that are very light-colored blue, indicating there are a lot of still very conservative, very rural parts of the state that are going to be very tough for any Democrat running for a statewide election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sarah, go ahead.
I think also on those lines, it'd be interesting to see looking at non-registered or independent voters in the next election, so seeing what counties you should really tap into for like swing counties.
Mm-hmm. And is party registration, does that always line up with predicting election outcomes, Chris, very quickly?
For the most part, yes.
It does. Okay. Yes. That is very quickly when you say yes. Okay. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, along with his student, Sarah Hoffmeyer, an interesting project creating a map to show changes in partisanship over the last five presidential elections for all Iowa counties in Iowa. Sarah and Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, it's time to check in with IPR's Jacqueline Hallbloom to find out what's happening on the Iowa arts scene. Jacqueline is the producer and host of Symphonies of Iowa, Performance Iowa, and Iowa Arts Showcase. Jacqueline, hello.
Hello.
We've got a number of really interesting things to talk about for arts fans in the state. Let's go to the Capitol and the Des Moines Metro Opera. Opera fans will want to tune into your program this time.
Well, even folks that maybe don't think they like opera should tune in, because the Des Moines Metro Opera has a fantastic 45th anniversary season for everyone. And there's going to be two epic works, Turandot, which is an epic fairy tale set in China. It has that big hit, Nessun Dorma. I'd sing it, but you'd turn your radio off. It's fantastic, and it's just wonderful. It's a huge, dramatic opera in the grandest fashion, and they're going to be heading off their season with that. They're also going to be doing Benjamin Britten's Billy Budd, which is another blockbuster, and this is features an all-male cast. They're going to have 80 guys on stage. Craig Verm is going to be singing the title role, and just an incredible, incredible show. This is a setting of Herman Melville's classic tale, and really gripping, gripping theater. And in the middle of all this, a special gem, Sondheim's A Little Night Music, which in 1973 won six Tonys, including Best Musical, Best Script, and Best Score. A really incredible lineup. Plus, they have all sorts of cool things. Now, the opera really doesn't kick off until June 23rd, but heading up to the opera, they're going to have some extra activities like film screenings of the Bergman film, Smiles of Summer Nights, that's on May 18th, along with Billy Budd on May 25th. Those are all at the Fleur Cinema and Cafe in Des Moines. They're also going to have Death by Aria at the Blank Performing Arts Center on May 27th. And then a whole bunch of other extra activities, including Threads and Trills, where you can see the costumes and hear the singers, Peanut Butter and Puccini Families and Kids, all sorts of cool things. So don't miss out.
This is to mark the 45th festival season of the Des Moines Metro Opera.
Right. And they are nationally recognized. They're in Opera Today and Opera News. This is right here in our own backyard. So take advantage of it. If you haven't been to opera, try it out. If you are an opera lover, definitely try it out.
For lovers of visual art, this is really something. When we go to Cedar Rapids, and I looked up some of this sculpture work by this artist who is a blown glass sculpture artist. This is going to be on display in Cedar Rapids. These are amazing, Jacqueline. Who does these?
This is Dale Chihuly, and he is unbelievable. He's like, he should be a character in Star Trek. I mean, he is out there, and his glass is incredible. And this is a chance to see a world-class artist. He is of international fame, and he started blowing glass back in 1967. He accidentally blew a glass bubble in the basement. Can you imagine? Hey, Mom, guess what I did? But anyway,
That accidentally happen?
I don't know. I'm just glad he didn't burn down the house, or so they say. But this eventually led to him. He started out individually blowing glass, but now he has teams of glass blowers, gaffers and shapers and blowers in this amazing hot shop. And he makes these incredible large sculptures, and they are going to be having three bottle stoppers that are like 40 inches tall there. Over 70 works, including this Laguna Murano chandelier, which has over 1,500 pieces of glass. They are bringing in three professional specialists just to put that together. Mm. It's a fantastic display, and I've just found out that this Strumpel private collection that they are going to be displaying is only going to be in Iowa, and after it comes to the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library, it's going to be packed up and put away. So this is your chance to see this incredible display, and not only that, but also this museum. If you haven't been to the National Czech and Slovak Museum, it's an incredible place too, but a wonderful opportunity. This show runs through October 1st. It's up now. Don't miss it.
Also on the Iowa Arts Showcase, you're taking a look at, well, you're talking with a maker of a documentary film about a certain civil rights case?
Yes, UNI's English professor and author Jeff Copeland originally in 2010 wrote Olivia's Story, The Conspiracy of Heroes Behind Shelley versus Kramer. And that led to the Missouri Historical Museum in St. Louis inviting him to make a documentary. Now, he's done some educational films, but never a documentary. But he didn't let them know that. He said, yes, I will do that. And this is an important case with the U.S. Supreme Court and is considered to be one of the most important rulings in history of the country, really, because before 1948, people were denied where they could purchase homes due to race, creed, and national origin. Well, right now, the only place you can see this documentary is at the Missouri Historical Museum, but they have it for 1 year, and then it'll obviously go on tour. It's been nominated for the Sundance Film Festival for next year, and it's just really an incredible story. You can find out more about Jeffrey Copeland. He has a blog, and he also has a website, and you can find out more about this really inspiring case. And, of course, listen on Saturday, and you'll find out a lot about the case.
Right, to the Iowa Arts Showcase airs Saturday at 11 in the morning. 5 p.m., also an airing on Iowa Public Radio. Finally, before we go, the Putnam Museum in Davenport, marking a big anniversary, Jacqueline. You spoke with the museum's executive director as part of the showcase this month.
They have so much going on, it's impossible to get it all squeezed in, but they're celebrating their sesquicentennial, and they did this big, huge picture display because they think museums are about people. So all the people in the community that wanted to got their pictures taken. They're all displayed. It's really cool. But they have so many cool things going on, and they have a couple of, well, I guess like three big screen movie theaters. They've got the Engineering Our World. They've also got Extreme Weather Showing. And they have this great magical history tour, a Beatles exhibition, which is on display right now. You can see the Fab Four from beginning to end. They're all there, and from the very, very beginning till the very end, it closes on June 4th. They have a place where you can take a selfie on Abbey Road, and they're also, through the whole month of May, showing Beatles movies, A Hard Day's Night and Imagine by John Lennon. And they are also going to have a rooftop concert on May 13th. Check it all out. There's a lot of cool things happening.
Check it all out, the Putnam Museum in Davenport. Make sure you get out and dust out that old walrus costume so you can say, I am the walrus, right, Jacqueline?
Yes.
Do you have... All right, Jacqueline. Let's go out with a little bit of the Magical Mystery Tour. One of the best albums, you'd have to agree, of all time. Jacqueline, thanks so much for an update of the Iowa Arts Showcase. Jacqueline hosts that program Saturdays at 11. And also at 5 p.m., also a little bit later, posted at iowapublicradio.org as a podcast. Jacqueline, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton with help from Chelsea Hoy. We had help from Jason Burns and Ames today. Also, Chris Fenton helped out in Cedar Falls. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer in a walrus suit. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us. Your knickers down. I am the Eggman.